From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game.
For USC, this is their championship game. They'll be number one for whoever wins Sunday. They're the ones who are really going to look at that asterisk and go, you know what? That takes our championship.
The Rose Bowl has created thorny issues for those inclined to feel that college football needs to produce a gall-dern number one champion every year. Ahead on Only a Game, reactions from New Orleans as fans of USC, LSU, and Oklahoma anticipate a winner emerging from tomorrow's Sugar Bowl. Maybe. Also ahead, New Yorkers celebrate the new year with some midnight running, a preview of the NFL's wild card weekend, and a review of 2003's best sports writing. Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Egyptian officials say it appears there were no survivors of an airplane crash off the resort of Sharm el-Sheikh this morning. The charter jet was carrying French tourists to Paris after a plane stopped at Cairo to change crews. The BBC's Paul Wood is in Cairo. He says government officials say they do not believe terrorists were to blame.
Looking at Flash Airlines' website, they say that this 737 was relatively new. It was manufactured in 1993, had the latest navigational equipment, and had a pilot on it with a minimum of 5,000 flying hours. Very experienced pilot, they say. Clearly more investigation has to be done, and of course for the Egyptians, any suggestion that terrorism might have been involved would be very damaging to their tourist economy, which provides about half of all the country's foreign currency earnings.
The BBC's Paul Wood in Cairo. South Asian leaders arrived in the Pakistani capital of Islamabad today for a regional summit. The meeting brings together the leaders of seven countries and is seen as a chance to improve relations between India and Pakistan. Tensions between those two countries prompted the cancellation of last year's summit. But Indian Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee told Indian television he would not meet separately with Pakistani officials, that he would focus on regional issues. A winter storm that dumped heavy rain and snow over Northern California is tapering off. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Sarah Varney reports.
The first storm of 2004 knocked out power to nearly 70,000 residents in the San Francisco Bay Area. South in the Santa Cruz Mountains, nearly 5 inches of rain caused scattered mudslides. In the Sierra Nevada, 4 feet of snow fell, closing highways and even stopping an Amtrak train. The train headed for the San Francisco Bay Area derailed west of Lake Tahoe, stranding 300 people for more than 14 hours. Claiborne Lockwood was trying to get home with her teenage daughter.
I think the hardest part was that the electricity went out. So none of the toilets work. You didn't have lights unless you brought a reading light or a flashlight. No hot food if there was any food.
Weary passengers finally arrived in the San Francisco Bay Area early Friday morning. Forecasters warn another winter storm is on the way to Northern California beginning Monday. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Varney in San Francisco.
The union representing striking grocery clerks in Southern California claims that Ralph's Grocery has allowed some clerks to work during the strike under false names and false Social Security numbers. The United Food and Commercial Workers Union filed a lawsuit yesterday asking the judge to stop the practice. The company denied the charge. A spokesman said it is against company policy to knowingly hire anyone who uses falsified documentation. You're listening to NPR News. While Democrat Howard Dean has captured the headlines for his presidential primary fundraising, some of his rivals picked up money yesterday from the Federal Election Commission. The first contest, the Iowa caucuses, will take place in 16 days. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
The Democratic money race is harder to handicap now because the candidates have been spending cash at different rates. But broadly speaking, it looks like this. Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean raised some $40 million last year. Senator John Kerry appears to be at about $29 million. He personally accounts for several million dollars of that. Congressman Dick Gephardt got around $21 million. That includes $3 million from the federal matching fund, money that Dean and Kerry have rejected because it comes with spending limits. And retired General Wesley Clark got around $17 million, again including a federal match. The federal dollars just went out, so they'll give some sort of boost to all of the candidates except Dean and Kerry. Whether it's enough of a boost will begin to become apparent later this month. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush will hold his first fundraiser of the year Monday in St. Louis. So far, the president has raised more than $120 million. Today, the president returns from vacation. He spent the last 8 days at his Texas ranch. Men's Fitness magazine has declared that Houston, Texas, is no longer the fattest city in the U.S. It's number two. The honor goes to Detroit. The magazine uses 14 categories to determine the fattest cities, such as the number of health clubs and the number of donut shops per capita and television viewing trends. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Tomorrow in New Orleans, Oklahoma will take on Louisiana State University in the Sugar Bowl to determine college football's national champion. Unless it doesn't determine that at all, because in Thursday's Rose Bowl, the University of Southern California trounced Michigan 28-14, thereby putting the probable kibosh on an outright number one, casting even more doubt on the already shaky bowl championship series and thoroughly confusing everybody. Only a Game's Nancy Greenlease ventured onto Bourbon Street as the Rose Bowl was being played, and she has this report.
It's Thursday evening outside Jackson Square, and football fans of two distinctive stripes stroll the streets. The hometown favorites, the LSU Tigers, prowl in purple and gold jerseys, sipping potent, slushy hurricanes in the same electric colors. Swarms of Oklahoma Sooner fans wear crimson and cream. But inside the corner oyster bar, a solitary couple go against the grain.
Yeah!
USC alums Carl Brensicki and Monica Arbeles wear scarlet and gold hats, sweatshirts, and Mardi Gras beads and watch USC in the Rose Bowl. They swallow oysters and some pride as they explain how many Trojans they've seen leading up to game time.
Two people only. And there were a couple people on the plane that had said, yeah, they were booked it early.
A lot of people telling us we were in the wrong town to go back home.
Yeah.
You know, aren't you guys a little confused? You must have hopped on the wrong flight. Going the wrong way.
Monica and Carl made plans months ago to attend the Sugar Bowl, convinced USC would get the nod. Instead, the bowl championship series booted the Trojans to third place and the Rose Bowl. Monica, who grew up near Pasadena and used to camp out for good Rose Bowl parade seats, decided to go ahead with her plans to march into the Crescent City.
We thought we'd get more sympathy cocktails from people, but that hasn't worked out, so.
Some people are like, oh, we feel bad. Some people are trying to rationalize why LSU's there, which is completely ridiculous. I mean, they're not even a real team.
A few tables away, some Tigers fans bare their fangs at Brensicki's dismissal. 2000 LSU grad Brian Barbier says the Tigers deserve their bid because the SEC is the country's most competitive conference.
It's not the Pac-10 where you play patsy after patsy. You got Little Sisters of the Poor, School for the Deaf. I mean, come on.
About all these two sides agree on is the sweet taste of cold beer and Oklahoma's good fortune to still land in the Sugar Bowl despite choking against Kansas State in the Big 12 championship game on December 6th. Again, Brian Barbier and New Orleans native Jason Bone.
Oklahoma lucked out. They don't deserve to be here.
Come Sunday night, it should have been USC and LSU, not Oklahoma and LSU.
But that doesn't wilt the beauty of this Rose Bowl victory for the only other table of USC fans here at the corner oyster bar.
This is the biggest thing that's happened since 78.
Richard Casaletta was 9 years old when USC won its last national championship 25 years ago. It transformed him into a Trojan fan, and he's now a season ticket holder. His friend Ethan Tyre, who's a UCLA fan, admits that crosstown rival USC may have the edge over Sunday's victor.
for USC, this is their championship game. They'll be number one. For whoever wins Sunday, they're the ones who are really going to look at that asterisk and go, you know what? That taints our championship.
Fans from all the teams blame the computers for this tarnished trophy. Castellette expects some changes next year to prevent another split decision.
Everyone's going to really think about this BCS. And what's the saying in California? Take the C out of BCS, and that's what you got.
For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlace in New Orleans.
Joining us now on the line to winnow this weekend's wild card winners from the Wannabes is Paul Attner, who covers all matters NFL for the Sporting News and for Only a Game. Welcome back, Paul.
Hi, Bill. It's a wild and wacky weekend.
Let's start with the first wild card game in which the Tennessee Titans will visit Baltimore this afternoon. Quoth Steve McNair, nevermore, at least as far as the Ravens are concerned?
Well, I think Steve McNair is claiming to be healthy, and a healthy Steve McNair would be too much for the Ravens. But we never know, you know, how healthy the guy really is. He seems to be kind of like Superman incarnate, and some weeks when he's hobbling, he plays well, and other weeks he doesn't. But my feeling is he's going to be good enough in this game to beat the Ravens, who are so one-sided. All they do is run the ball, and I think that's not going to be enough to win this one.
Tonight, the Carolina Panthers will host Bill Parcells' Cowboys. Will this be a so-called character builder for an improving team, or do the Cowboys, or anybody else for that matter, believe that the Big Tuna can help the team swim all the way to Houston for the Super Bowl?
I think they drown tonight. I think they're going to be calling for a lifeguard. Dallas is a creation of Bill Parcells. He's done a wonderful job, but they're not good enough to beat the best teams in the league, and he knows that. Carolina, the only way they lose this game tonight, Bill, is if they give it to him, just by making mistakes and not playing as well as they should. But all things even, Carolina is a better team.
Tomorrow, former Packers and now Seahawks head coach Mike Holmgren will attempt to upset Green Bay at Lambeau Field. Will that spoil a terrific story?
No. Well, first of all, we're not going to – Holmgren wouldn't do that to us. I mean, he wouldn't dare interfere with the Brett Favre story as it's unfolding. And secondly, Seattle away from Seattle is one of those fish that will drown also, because they just are not very good on the road. And this is a team in Green Bay that I think is one of the better teams in the league right now, despite the fact they barely qualify for the playoffs. And I think they'll start proving it by overwhelming the Seahawks and winning fairly easily.
Also tomorrow, the Denver Broncos will try to adjust to Indiana's low altitude as they attempt to knock the Indianapolis Colts out of the first round. What do you think?
Well, thank goodness they like to run on the ground, huh? That'll really help them. This is going to be the best game of the weekend. I mean, it's a rematch. They just played a couple of weeks ago when Denver played one of the nearly perfect games I've ever seen in the NFL. Just absolutely dominated Indianapolis. It will not be that kind of game this time. I still think Denver is a better team. Much like Green Bay, they have the kind of offensive balance that we don't see that much in the league anymore, and I think that's enough to be able to beat Indy again. But this is one that's worth the price of admission. It's going to be a really terrific contest.
Paul, we last spoke about a month ago, at which time you opined that Tennessee would be the team to beat in the playoffs. Now, assuming you still feel that way, that would mean the Titans are capable of beating the Patriots, Chiefs, Eagles, and Rams. Are you sticking by your assertion?
Well, can we talk about this after tomorrow? I want to get this round done. Tennessee certainly has not played as well since we last talked, and it's just right on Steve McNair, because he's hurt. I mean, without him, they're not a very good team, but you could say that about a lot of teams if they lose their quarterback. I think if McNair has any kind of decent health, I think Tennessee is as good as anybody in the league. But you've got New England looming there, and New England is convincing me more and more how good they are. The Patriots just don't seem to want to lose, no matter what the situation, no matter what team they're playing. But I think Tennessee, a New England-Tennessee matchup would be a good one for all football fans to watch.
New England is the favorite in Las Vegas.
Yep.
I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing going into the tournament. What do you think?
Well, I think New England is a different world for New England than 2 years ago, when, by the way, I never thought they'd win the Super Bowl. So I would, you know, come right up front, because I know you probably remind me of that one. You know, the Patriots were kind of like under the radar 2 years ago. Right now they're the hunter, and it's a cliche, but it's true. I mean, it's a different world for them. There's pressure on them. Everyone expects them to make it to the Super Bowl and win it, and they're going to have to cope with that. And it's not as easy as just kind of going in without any pressure on them at all. And I'm not, there is not a dominant team in this league, including New England. There's not a team that you look at like the old Steelers, the old Packers, even the Cowboys of the early 90s. And because there's no dominant team, I don't think an opponent is afraid of anybody that they're going to play, including the Patriots, which means they're vulnerable to an upset.
We haven't talked much at all about the Philadelphia Eagles.
Right.
If they go all the way and win the Super Bowl, we'd have a certain nameless cartoon character talk radio host eating crow, which is enough to make me root for the Eagles. How about you?
We're in this one together, aren't we? The Eagles are a remarkable story. I would not have said that prior to the season if they'd gotten this far, because they should be where they are. I mean, they came into this season as one of the best teams in the league. They got off to a terrible start. Donovan McNabb got off to a terrible start as their quarterback. The Rush Limbaugh situation came up. A whole lot of reasons came together where you thought the Eagles would not even make it to the playoffs. Instead, they come into the playoffs as the NFC's hottest team. And they're the best team in the NFC, but much like the Patriots, they're also they have weaknesses. They have flaws. And those flaws, if exposed by an opponent, the Eagles are capable of losing. But it'd be a nice human interest story to see McNabb get to the Super Bowl.
I'm going to leave it to our listeners to decide whether you have, in fact, clarified the playoff picture at all.
I'm trying not to, because I keep going on these limbs that you remind me of, in a few weeks, and I'm sure we'll visit them. But if you want Super Bowl picks from me, Bill, just ask, and I'll probably give you something.
All right, let's have it.
All right, I think that the Titans and the Eagles will wind up playing in the Super Bowl, and I'm sure that will thrill all Patriot fans everywhere.
Paul Attner covers the NFL for the Sporting News, and he's only a Games Pro pigskin prognosticator as well. Paul, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill.
With the wild card, he had a wild card. The luckiest man I ever saw. Draw a wild card, every draw a wild card. Another wild card.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
The way she played her little game made those other cards look tame. A wild card, oh, she was a wild card. The sharpest gal you'd ever chance to see. Well, she took me to the railing, and the moon was big and high. We'd only kissed, and then I missed the stick pin from a tie. My watch went next, then my ring, and brother, it's the truth. I wasn't worried until I'd lost my golden pivot to this wild card, a wicked wild card. This little lady.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. I know this is not the best time in the world, said Brian Shipwash to Chandra Miller, but will you marry me? Shipwash had just crashed the motorcycle upon which he and Miller had been riding into a pickup truck. The handlebars of the motorcycle were embedded in Shipwash's abdomen, but he remained lucid enough to recall that they'd been heading up Pilot Mountain in North Carolina so that he could propose in a particularly lovely setting. Instead, Shipwash popped the question from flat on his back on the road. The box containing the ring was broken and blood-spattered, and several fellow bikers were trying to pull the Harley off their pal at the time. No matter. Chandra Miller said yes. It turned out that nobody was seriously injured. The nuptials will presumably be less dramatic than the proposal.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NHL action, the Columbus Blue Jackets shut out Tampa Bay 2-0. Philadelphia flummoxed Florida 2-1. Detroit downed Carolina 4-1. Buffalo stopped Anaheim 5-2. And Phoenix blanked Dallas by a score of 6-0. Elsewhere, the Edmonton Oilers edged the Minnesota Timberwolves 2-1. The San Jose Sharks fell to the Chicago Blackhawks by the same score. And the Colorado Avalanche doubled up the Vancouver Canucks 4-2. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce reviews the 2003 sports year. But first, the Best American Sports Writing Series has been brightening the lives of literate sports fans for 13 years. Glenn Stout has been the series editor throughout that run. Buzz Bissinger is the guest editor of the current edition. They join me now. Glenn from the studios of Vermont Public Radio in Colchester, Vermont. Hello again, Glenn.
Hi, Bill.
And Buzz from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Buzz, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, thank you, Bill.
Buzz, I want to start with something you wrote in the introduction to this year's volume. You maintain that reading the candidates for Best American Sports Writing rekindled your enthusiasm for our games. How did that happen?
Well, you know, it happened that as I got about 75 to 80 entries from Glenn, and, you know, I think like many people in this country, I was pretty turned off by sports. So, you know, whether it's the Kobe situation, I find I watch less and less on television. I just can't stand it. And reading these entries just reminded me of the purity of the game, the poignancy, how haunting it can be, how beautiful it can be, how spontaneous it can be. And I really had forgotten that. And this is not apocryphal. Reading these entries really reaffirmed to me what is great about sports and what will always make me kind of a lifelong fan of the game.
Now, I don't want to naysay that contention, but ironically, some of the stories in this collection are pretty discouraging. Renee Chun's story entitled Bobby Fischer's Pathetic Endgame, for example.
Well, you know, I think I have a dark personality, sort of. That's just part of my temperament. And some of the stories are dark because I guess darkness appeals to me. That particular story appealed to me because, I mean, I had no idea how completely screwed up Bobby Fischer was. And it just was a story that affected me very, very deeply. And in picking the selections, it's not really conscious, but you're looking for a mix of stories, whether it's the darkness of Bobby Fischer or, you know, whether it's, you know, people, the Pancho Gonzalez story, kind of this wonderful tennis player who went on hard times, just trying to find a certain balance of things that appeal to me, that to me represent the good, the bad, and the ugly of sports.
One of the challenges somebody writing about very famous athletes faces is getting beyond the stories that everybody else has already written about those very famous athletes. Glenn, were you surprised to encounter fresh stories about Barry Bonds and Shaquille O'Neal?
You know, not anymore. I think that years ago when I started this process, I expected that I would get the same old stories about the same old people time after time after time. But what I've found over the years is that you can never underestimate the inventiveness of the writers. And it doesn't surprise me anymore that there are new stories about Barry Bonds or new stories about Shaquille O'Neal. There might be stories about Barry Bonds and Shaquille O'Neal in next year's book that are just as surprising and just as fresh as these. I mean, the writers seem to step up to the challenge, particularly with these transcendent athletes, the people that you think you know everything about. You know, that's a real challenge for writers, and I'm continually not surprised by the way that they seem to come up with something new.
And I think Glenn is exactly right. And I think that's also what turned me on sort of back to sports and also turned me on to this wonderful craft of sports writing is the ability of writers to take subjects that we think we know, that we think we know a lot about, and through great reporting and writing come up with all sorts of things that are still really a treasure to read. And that to me was really, really a turn on and very, very affirming.
Glenn, you mentioned in your introduction that about a quarter of the stories in this collection were written by women. Certainly women do not constitute a quarter of the folks writing about sports these days. I wonder if they just write better.
Well, I think in many instances they may write differently. The female writers that have appeared in this book, to my mind anyway, seem less constrained and bound by what they should be writing about or from the perspective they should be writing about. I mean, if you look in this year's book, there's a wonderful story by Elizabeth Kay about Phil Jackson that's written in an entirely different way from any other sports story I've ever seen done. She essentially takes about 35 snapshots, mm-hmm. and they're like 35 little prose poems about Phil Jackson. Now, there are a lot of wonderful male sports writers, but I've read a lot of sports writing over the last 13, 14 years, and I've never read a story written precisely that way. There's another story by Beth Kephart about ice skating and how she relates ice skating to writing. That, again, is just something. I don't know if the essay is about ice skating. I don't know if it's about writing, but it's a great piece of writing that seems to cover both of them. And somehow I haven't come across something written by a male writer talking about, you know, pitching as a metaphor for the way he's living his life. You know, so I really think that they are a little bit less constrained. Female writers are coming at sports from a new perspective. They're not tired of it. And what you find in a lot of sports writing by a lot of male sports writers is a certain fatigue factor that has to be overcome. I simply don't see that in a lot of the writing I get from women.
Part of what I like best about American sports writing every year is that each volume introduces me to a sport about which I previously knew very little, if anything at all. Buzz, I wonder if you feel the same way, especially regarding the account of Demolition Derby that Susie Buchanan contributed to this collection.
Well, I mean, that story was just a trip. I mean, I think I've watched it a little bit on television. I watch it for 30 seconds, and then I sort of turn it off. I mean, I just love that story. It was a blast to read. It had all these vivid, crazy characters. There were the Shoeless Brothers and these guys who don't wear shoes. I mean, it was just the embodiment of sports can be crazy. It can be different. I adored that story, and it was such a delight, you know, to see it. I mean, who knew? And that's what's great about doing this, is because it's always, you know, who knew? Who knew what was out there in sport? Because you figure, my God, we read so much about it. It's on TV all the time. It's in newspapers. It's in magazines. And yet someone is out there just coming up with some really, really great gem. And I didn't realize that a quarter of the writers in the collection were women. It probably has to do with the fact I'm divorced and sort of subliminally looking for a date. I mean, who the hell knows?
Glenn, I know that you make the initial cut for each volume. There are two Bill Plaschke stories in this book. How many Plaschkes did you send along to Buzz?
I think I might have sent
not enough.
Three. Well, you know, so I think he's one of those writers. He's on a roll right
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely.
And that's happened in this book before where, you know, you get stories by the same author 2-3 years running, and sometimes multiple stories, and sometimes they never come back, and sometimes they do. But Bill is a wonderful writer, and he's just been writing some killer stories. And, you know, we don't exclude the book to only one appearance by a writer each year. If you write three great stories, we'll put those three great stories in here, because the writing can carry it. No one appears in the book as a courtesy, and Bill's certainly not in it as a courtesy, but he has continued to write some killer stories. I mean, to get literally inside the San Diego Chicken's head.
Yeah, and who would even want to do that? I mean, as he describes it, like it's like the inside of a moldy shower stall. I mean, on that basis alone. But I love that story because Bill, and I love both his stories, because he's more of an old-fashioned sports writer who really knows his craft, and the sentences tend to be short, but, you know, short can be great, and I think Bill really, really has it down where and how many words he has, if it's 1,500 or 2,000, he just creates a vivid, vivid portrait. And that portrait of the chicken to me was just haunting. I mean, I knew nothing about this guy really, except I remember the San Diego Chicken, you know, prancing around like an idiot, making a fool of himself. But he really took it a step further, a really interesting kind of sad portrait of a guy, like an all-star pitcher who was kind of washed up and, you know, trying to find himself once his, you know, his fastball was gone. I just love that story.
It seems to me that there are an unusual number of stories about damaged people in this collection. Bill Johnson, the former ski racer who suffered brain damage during a crash. The story about Jim McLaren, the former athlete who's now a quadriplegic after two terrifying accidents. Then there's Terry Pluto's account of the autistic man who functions as a water boy. And there are others. Buzz, did you consciously lean toward this kind of story?
Well, you know, Bill, as you mentioned it, I realized that when you're guest editor, it really becomes sort of a psychological Rorschach of yourself. And it's clear that I think of myself as being damaged, dark, and nostalgic in some sense. It was not conscious, but obviously when you do a collection like this, I mean, you're drawn to what interests you. And I found those particular stories to be haunting, to be poignant. They were the kind of stories that I thought about. you know, as I'm trying to get to sleep at night, I've been fascinated by what does happen to the athlete after the cheers end, because I think there is nothing like it in American life. I mean, we all remember Bo Jackson, you know, until he ruined his hip on that play with the Oakland Raiders. And what happens to these guys, and where do they go? It is so hard to process, and I really was, I guess, taken with these stories of damage, because I thought they were beautifully written and gave some insight into the athletic condition, which I think is something we forget about, because so much of our focus is on what's being done now and who's scoring the touchdown and all the gossipy aspects. But what happens when the cheering ends? And that's been a theme when I've written about sports. I really care about a lot.
I think those stories are interesting, too, because even though they may be, in some sense, sad stories, they're not dead ends. You know, there's an element of transcendence or the attempt at transcendence in each of those. If they're just dead ends, then they're not interesting. But you see sort of why some of these people continue to go on or try to continue to go on, and how sports kind of fits in with that, you know, day-to-day struggle that everybody has to continue their life.
And that's particularly true in the Elizabeth Gilbert. I mean, the Lucky Jim, not to go into the details, not to give it away, how that guy, given what he has been through, which is so incredible in and of itself, two very, very serious accidents that ultimately leave him paralyzed, how he gets up in the morning has any faith in life, to me, was a real wake-up call to all of us. Because, you know, I'm a writer, so I pity myself more than anybody. And for him to be able to get up and have something to cling to in life, I found that story in its own dark way to be very, very inspirational.
Glenn, your job requires you to read so many sports-related stories every year. Can you put your finger on an absolute positive favorite this time around?
Oh, wow. You know, that's a challenge every year. You know, I tend to try to put my absolute favorite at the front of the book, and he just mentioned the Lucky Jim story about the luckiest unlucky man on the face of the earth, I think. And that's one that I might take with me onto that desert island, because as Buzz said, that's a story that is inspirational, and not cheesy TV movie inspirational, but almost blood and guts inspirational, because it's not a trite story, and it's not made trite, and it's not just wrapped up in a nice bow, but you really see the process that this individual has to go through with what he's gone through. And it's remarkable. So I think I'd have to sit on that one. And I also just love the delicacy of Beth Kephart's story about ice skating and writing, which is, you know, about the best 750 words that I've read in a long, long time.
And that's what's also cool about this process. And as a writer, reading these stories was very helpful to me. And then I think I said this to Glenn. I've come to one conclusion about all writing, is that we all write too long. Because in 750 words, I mean, Beth just captures the beauty of how sport can impact your writing life. And this wasn't conscious, but some of the best things, you know, Plaschke's stuff is not that long. And there was a piece about being in the cockpit of an America's Cup boat that was, I think, probably about 1,000 words. And you really see the way in which writers still rely on the economy of language. I remember reading somewhere someone saying the worst thing that ever happened to writers was the computer, because, you know, it's so easy now to write and to move and to do all this stuff. And we all just, you know, we vomit out of our mouths way, way too much, or at least with our fingers. So there was something Billy didn't ask, but of course I'll answer. I actually don't have a favorite. I mean, I think they all struck me in one way or another, but they all had a certain thing to them that I adored.
Glenn Stout is the series editor for Houghton Mifflin's Best American Sports Writing. Glenn, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Bill. Nice to talk to you again.
And Buzz Bissinger is the guest editor for the 2003 volume of this excellent series. Buzz, thank you.
Hey, thank you.
You're listening to Only a Game. Nora Charles, an Only a Game listener from Lake Topowingo, Missouri, headed an email she sent us in defense of fruitcake. She found my pre-Christmas discussion with the organizer of a fruitcake eating contest rife with derogatory comments about the comestible and wrote, quote, "You should have had my grandmother's fruitcake. I once accidentally left one behind and begged to have it shipped to me as soon as possible. Dark and chewy with a molasses base, this fruitcake was to die for." Incidentally, the winner of the aforementioned fruitcake eating contest in Buffalo, New York, on Tuesday was Sonia Thomas, a 105-pound woman who consumed just under 5 pounds of the holiday treat in 10 minutes. Also in the December 20th show, Charlie Pierce and I noted the passing of former Cleveland Browns quarterback Otto Graham, which provoked this response from Leave Williams, a New Hampshire Public Radio listener.
The thing that Otto should be remembered for is the fact that he never smoked, he never drank, and he was a family man, and he taught me how to throw a basketball. He just was a good, good guy. It's a great family. So thanks again for the piece.
The women of Penzic War have apparently organized a campaign to hammer Only a Game associate producer Karen Given for not sufficiently recognizing the presence of the women as combatants in the story Karen wrote last summer. One of the more reserved comments, "To every woman on the field of battle, this report amounts to a grievous insult," came from Mari Hirsch Tudor, also known as Sisera Blackwork Del Oogly of the Shire of Coldwood, East Kingdom. Don Marshall, who hears the program on WAMC in Albany, New York, wrote, "I listened faithfully, but where is the rugby news? Can anyone say World Cup?" Finally, Curtis Harris, a member of the Professional Bowlers Association, wrote of Karen Given's recent story on the PBA Tour, "I was pleased to finally hear a story about one of the most popular participatory sports in the world. Bowling gets so little press that any story is good news. One thing you may not know is that at just about the time the Women's Pro Soccer League was folding up its tent, so was the Ladies Pro Bowling Tour. I was saddened and outraged that no one even noticed." Your comments will reach us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. From our website, onlyagame.org, you can send us a message. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company, with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan & Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Cub fans dance on Waveland Avenue.
Reverse the curse, rally,
the Bulls basketball dynasty begins with a shot.
Here's Michael at the foul line. A shot on Elo. The Bulls win!
Can't come up with anything for the Blackhawks or White Sox at the moment. I'm Scott Simon. Tune in for Chicago sports and maybe sports from beyond. And, oh, right, we almost forgot the news on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob C. with eSports Headlines. In yesterday's NBA action, Washington topped Golden State by a score of 97-79. Indiana outpaced Boston 103-90. New Jersey clobbered Cleveland 97-82. Detroit foiled Phoenix 93-81. Memphis beat Utah 100-88. Denver vanquished Portland 106-96. And New Orleans toppled Toronto 86-74. Elsewhere, Chicago triumphed over New York 104-99. Miami burned Orlando 112-101. Minnesota manhandled Atlanta 93-75. Milwaukee dumped Dallas 109-101. And Seattle edged the Lakers 111-109. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a New Year's tradition that happily does not include Dick Clark. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me to muse on the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Happy New Year, Bill.
Charlie, it is, of course, traditional at this time to think in terms of bests and worsts. Is there something in the world of sports that leaps out for you in either of those categories?
Well, I mean, the ongoing best story is Lance Armstrong and how many times can he win the Tour de France? The worst story, boy, the competition there this year is overwhelming between the Kobe Bryant disaster and the absolute tabloid fiasco that was the Baylor basketball team. Just when you thought there was nothing to surprise you in this little world of ours, these two stories come along.
In addition to your being El Predicto, Mr. NASCAR, and assorted other titles, you
are... And the Living Heisman.
As well as the Living Heisman, you are our very own College Bowl guy, so I expect you to comment today upon the most recent bowls and perhaps the semi-big one tomorrow.
Well, the worst possible thing for the Bowl Championship Series happened, which was that Southern California went on national television and beat what Mark Twain would call the everlasting aspirations out of the University of Michigan and looked very much like the best team in the country, thereby rendering that huge piece of glassware that will be contended over by Oklahoma and LSU almost superfluous. Southern Cal is the best college team in the country. Southern Cal is the national champion.
The National Football League playoff schedule has been established. Tell me which teams have arrived in the postseason healthy and confident, and which ones are already booking tee times for next weekend.
Well, as you know, Bill, up here in Boston, we have the bestest team in the bestest league in the bestest country
favorite.
In all the world.
2-1 favorite.
We're all bets. Being very giddy, and you know, we're all rubbing the precious up here. we're all rubbing the precious. Actually, there is no reason why the New England Patriots can't play in the Super Bowl. They play 2 home games. They're healthy. They got a couple of weeks off. They're playing better than any team in the league. And it is entirely possible that the Patriots will wind up playing the winner of the Tennessee-Baltimore game, which is going to be a bloodbath. Whoever comes out of that game is not going to be prepared to play a healthy New England Patriots team. So it is very rare that the moon is so securely in the seventh house the way it is for the Patriots right now.
Among the teams that did not make the playoffs, there have been several coaching changes. Is Steve Spurrier's resignation as the Washington Racial Slurs head coach the most surprising development in that arena?
Yeah, I think so. Bill Callahan losing his job, I might add, 1 year after appearing in the Super Bowl was no surprise because his team didn't play well and it's owned by a lunatic.
Mm-hmm. That would be the Raiders.
But that's exactly right. I give Spurrier credit for realizing he's not up to the job, although he'll never admit that he's up to any job up to and including God. But the guy I would hate to be today is Ron Zook, who succeeded Spurrier at the University of Florida, because his team got absolutely slaughtered in a bowl game. And there's already a website called RonZookMustBeFired.com.
Oh.
And Steve Spurrier is out of a job. This cannot be the beginning of a happy new year.
Speaking of teams that didn't make the playoffs this time around, Tampa Bay won the whole thing last year. What happened to them?
Well, their offense fell apart. They had a bunch of injuries. I think they got a little chubby with success, and I don't think there's any question they'll be back next year. I think what you're looking at with Tampa Bay is exactly the situation you looked at with the Patriots a couple years ago. They won the Super Bowl. They missed the playoffs the next year, and they came back with a vengeance. I would not want to play Tampa Bay next year.
The Bush administration announced on Tuesday its intention to ban ephedra. This is a supplement used by people trying to control their weight. Also by Baltimore Orioles pitcher Steve Beckler last February. It killed him, apparently. Is the decision to ban ephedra a significant development?
I guess it is. The ban isn't immediate because there's some paperwork. The earliest it could take effect is in March. Science marches on. Something will replace ephedra down the line, and we'll have another 6 months of running around screaming and shouting with our hair on fire before that gets banned, and we'll continue to ban things as though we're improving anyone's lot in life.
In a final accounting for 2003, ESPN figured out that the Yankees will owe almost $50 million to the least profitable Major League Baseball teams under the current revenue-sharing plan. Does this constitute an assumption by ESPN that George Steinbrenner has finished acquiring players?
No. I mean, of course it does, but that's mad because he hasn't, because all the Red Sox have to do is sneeze and he'll pick up 2 more outfielders. But I think the interesting thing, of course, will be to track where this $48 million goes. Does it go into player development in Kansas City, or does it go into somebody's pocket?
This week, the University of Connecticut men's basketball team returned to the number one spot in the ESPN USA
Today. Well, wait a
minute.
Marquette returned to number 23.
The women's team at UConn, of course, has never forfeited their number one ranking. Will we see both of those teams on top at the end of the season, or just one of them, or neither?
Of the teams I've seen this year, Duke is the best team. Connecticut is second. The surprise teams, of course, are Wake Forest and Georgia Tech, both of them in Duke's league. I think by the end of the year, Connecticut, which is clearly the best team in the Big East this season, once it gets into its conference schedule, will wind up as the number one team as we go into the big picnic in March.
The college basketball game that I would most like to have attended this season saw Colorado State beat Purdue on Tuesday night under thoroughly remarkable circumstances. Michael Morris of Colorado State knocked down 2 3-pointers in 0.7 seconds. How did he do that?
The smart answer, Bill, the smart guy answer, thereby violating my New Year's resolution almost immediately, is he threw the ball through the basket twice from a long way away. It was sort of a demonstration about what the problem of overcoaching in college basketball.
Mm.
Gene Katie, the coach at Purdue, who's a very good coach and has been there for years and is very successful, made a whole bunch of one notch too far coaching moves, including pulling somebody off the free throw line, which gave Morris the opportunity to get the second 3-pointer away. The lesson is that, you know, sometimes, you know, college basketball coaches, you can think too much.
Well, I just love the idea that even at a high-level game, the instruction to the offense can be throw the ball toward the basket as soon as you get your hands on it.
That's right.
Meanwhile,
it's the equivalent, Bill, of the classic NHL advice, which is when in doubt, throw it in front of the net.
There you go. Meanwhile, on Sunday, an American Hockey League game between Philadelphia and Binghamton ended early, and at least some of the players involved regarded the affair as, quote, a team bonding experience. What was that all about?
Well, the problem was Binghamton and Philadelphia had so many players thrown out they couldn't finish the game. The last fight, this is my favorite part of the story, the last fight took place with 8 seconds left in a 5-1 game. What was there to get angry about?
Maybe they were just trying to set this record. You know, be two teams that couldn't finish the game because there weren't enough players outside the penalty box.
Things got heated, said the Philadelphia coach, and we stood up for each other.
There you go. Finally, Charlie, you and I have talked about a number of different record-setting performances over the years. Where do you rank Indiana automotive worker Gene Wethington's 52 hours and 15 minutes of nonstop bowling?
Well, I think in the recorded history of America's thumb sports, this is the all-time record. He took 15-minute breaks every 8 hours where he used the restroom, relaxed in a chair, and had his blood pressure checked because he does have high blood pressure, but he never slept. He bowled 7 nights a week anyway. He played 270 games and knocked down, Bill, 31,789 pins. His best game was a 225, which came early. No surprise here.
We could never spare Charlie Pierce, who writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
To reach the unreachable star.
For too many, New Year's Eve means indulgence in all manner of destructive behavior, from heavy drinking to watching heinous TV marathons of the worst shows ever. But for the last 25 years, a group of New Yorkers has found an alternative to such folly in the Midnight Run, which features 5,000 racers, colorful costumes, food, music, fireworks, and even non-alcoholic champagne. Only A Game's Karen Pellin joined some of the running revelers and their retinue on Wednesday night at the 72nd Street Bandshell in Central Park, and she produced this audio montage.
This event is very special. The Runner's World Midnight Run started 25 years ago. We wanted to give people an alternative to sitting home, going to bars, or going to Times Square. The music is great. It's a beautiful night. It's clear. The moon is out. And who could ask for anything more for the beginning of the new year?
So in those 25 years, what's been the most bizarre sort of thing that's happened?
Well, it's been some of the costumes. One year, we always get a lot of baby New Year's dressed up in just diapers. One year, a guy came without diapers. We figured maybe he'd win. We've had the Brooklyn Bridge, one running club at 25 people that made up the bridge with the various expanses. We've had the city skyline. Very, very creative stuff. It's a great time to be in the park and to be in New York City.
So we have a winner.
Are you ready for this, New York? The Runner's World Midnight Run. Costume Parade winner. Getting a $150 gift certificate to Schaefer City Oyster Bar and Grill is the man from NASA.
So, congratulations. You got first place. What's your name and where are you from?
My name is Bob Stabry, and I'm from Fairfield, Connecticut.
And did I hear correctly, this is the second year in a row you've won?
Yeah, I won last year as an alien, the year before as Batman, and another year we had an aquarium set up with a mermaid in it, and I was a captain pushing the tank. I've done this 16 years.
16 years?
Yeah.
And this year you are a...
astronaut in a space shuttle, because they're trying to bring attention back to flight and space, and I just thought it'd be a good time to do it.
Okay, and what is this, about 6, 7, 8 feet long?
8 feet long, yep. It's fiberglass and styrofoam, and I had to take it apart to get it here and then assembled it out on a sidewalk and rolled it in.
And are you going to run with this?
In the spacesuit, but not with this. It's too bulky.
Well, good luck in the race, and we'll see you next year, I guess.
Thank you very much.
Literally next year, and then next year.
Thanks.
I need to have everybody that's on this start line make some noise! I'm still in here.
Sure, we're walking.
No, you're not.
Yeah, this is not running. This is walking.
I'm running.
Okay.
Well, that's
short legs.
Lovely shorts you're wearing.
My wife picked them out.
What's your name? Where are you from?
Joe Cliff, New York, Texas.
New York, Texas?
Yeah.
What's New York, Texas?
Both.
Oh, got it. And you're the wife that picked out the shorts?
No, that's...
Sorry, you're the wife that picked out the shorts.
Yes.
We have matching. You're Matt.
Very good.
What's your name?
Tappy.
Have you ever done this before?
No.
Why did you do it?
Because we've always wanted to, and it's our anniversary tonight.
Oh, happy anniversary. How many years?
15.
Oh, congratulations.
What's your name?
My name's Karen.
Hi, Karen.
Anyway, I'm not really in registered here. I'm just running to talk to people, so I'm going to stop now and go back.
Have fun.
Okay, happy New Year.
Hey, you too. Bye.
The old record set last year was 1922. This year, 1836. From Morro Bay, California, Christian Hesch. 1836, that's running.
So, what are your names and where are you from?
Bruce Smikas, Greenlawn.
You can't talk?
I just pushed her.
Oh.
Bruce Smikas from Greenlawn and Travis Tate from East Northport.
And you have you done this race before?
Yeah,
last year.
Did you find the race to be easier this year?
No.
Yeah, but our training's come along pretty good.
We've been training hard.
She's getting ready for a half marathon. I'm getting ready for a marathon, so it's...
Good way to begin the new year.
What's it like out there on the course? Is it dark or
really hilly and dark.
Well, yeah. I don't know. The fireworks pretty well.
Yeah.
Lit up pretty well.
The fireworks lit up the course?
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, great finish. Totally love it.
Our audio montage was produced by Karen Pellin. Each new year gives us hope, I guess. I hope that that's the case. We hope, if we are fans, that our home teams move up a place, or two, or three, or four, or more, if we are Tigers fans, though I'm not sure Detroit has that much winning in its plans. I hope that somehow those who run the NFL will see that players with concussions aren't being all that they can be, and that they're damaged, not just groggy, and there should be blame assigned to all the jerks who put those guys back in the game. I hope as well that colleges employing pros to play will manage somehow against all odds to quietly convey to the odd monstrous lineman and the celebrated star, the gold-draped hero driving in that bright late-model car, that checking out a class or two and trying to graduate might be a course they might pursue before it gets too late. Besides the hopes I bring to this new year, I bring regrets, or anyway, concerns we should address herein. So let's acknowledge that the Rockers out of Cleveland are no more, and women's basketball has not grown as it might have, nor have women's fortunes flourished where the world game is concerned. Before a lot more years have passed, I hope the suits have learned that backing women's soccer is a more productive use of all the mighty power of their mighty corporate juice than showering each new male star with many, many millions. Or am I wrong? Are Tiger and LeBron now counting billions? I hope that the Olympics will be only games and fun, a festive time and place where jumpers jump and runners run, and all the news is how fast and how high and by what score, and not who failed a drug test or got held up at the door and missed her competition while delayed at a checkpoint because the guards felt that they had to lock down the whole joint. No matter which teams win and which must wait until next year, I hope that in 04 you find a lot that makes you cheer. What else by way of closure is there left for me to say? From now until 05, may all the close calls go your way. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Parati. We had help this week from Sam Sanders at Vermont Public Radio and from Al Banks at WHYY in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or check out Midnight Run photos from New Year's Eve. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Best American Sports Writing series editor Glenn Stout, who says that he enjoyed sharing selection responsibilities with 2003 guest editor Buzz Bissinger.
When I get the hate mail, I can blame Buzz. And when he gets the hate mail, he can blame me. So that, in a sense, leaves us both blameless at the end of the whole process.
Well, it's one way to look at it, I guess. The other is that passing the buck to Buzz and vice versa leaves you both blameful. And we'll get some email on my use of that word, I'm sure. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
So by the way at work and play, we'll be seeing you. Goodbye.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.